So rough outline of the talk, one, introduction, two, then I'll give some details, and then three will be some numerical results. And this work is joint with Lisa Glaser. So I've got to remember to mention her there. Okay, so introduction. So so the first thing is to talk about the way I want to talk about geometry. And the key idea from Alain Kahn is that you should talk about the Dirac operator. So I'm talking about Riemannian geometry here. And usually, you know, you write some formula like something like this. Yeah, plus something else, and that's your Dirac operator on a manifold. And then, of course, this frame field here contains the metric. And so you can read off the metric and vice versa. If you know the metric, you can write down the Dirac operator. So we're interested in the non-commutative generalization. And in this generalization, the algebra of functions on your manifold here become non-commutative. Functions, which is, of course, commutative on a manifold, becomes a non-commutative algebra. And the idea is this algebra comes in to saying what a Dirac operator is. I mean, in particular, you know, this formula here is a first-order differential operator. And the way you say it's a first-order differential operator is you say, well, if you take the commutator with any function, and then you take the commutator with another function, that's zero. Okay, so you need to know what the functions are to say what it means for this to be a Dirac operator. Okay, so now I modify the notion of functions a bit, make it non-commutative, and I have a similar axiom, it's not exactly that, but like that, which tells me what, still tells me what a Dirac operator is. Okay, and I'll give explicit formulas a bit later. So, where shall I go? Yeah, here. Yeah. Okay, so the particular application we're interested in is in particle physics, although it has many other applications. And in particle physics, you have a product space, M cross F. M is the usual space-time. So it's a commutative manifold. So just R4 or something like it. and F is called the internal space, and it's non-commutative. And the structure of this non-commutative internal space is responsible for a lot of the, well, everything that we know about. A lot of things we know about the structure of the standard model of particle physics are coded into this non-commutative internal space.
What goes wrong if you don't use Riemannian geometry?
You mean if you use Lorentzian or... Yes. Oh, I see. You just have to modify the axioms a bit. But I don't want to talk about that. I'm talking about the Riemannian... Yes, it's doable, although not studied so much. So, yeah. Riemannian's easier. Okay, so that's the standard particle physics. And now I want to explain what my project is, which I can do here. So firstly, I want to sort of complete the job. You see, this is a sort of hybrid thing. You've got a commutative spacetime and non-commutative internal space. And if you actually believe in non-commutative geometry, then this looks really strange. So the first part of the project is to replace M with a non-commutative geometry space. It's a geometry. And then the next thing I want to do is to truncate to a finite number of modes. Physics speak. So in other words, I want the A to be finite dimensional. Math speak. And then I want to compute something. So this is going to disappear, isn't it? Boards don't commute. So compute something. In random non-commutative geometry. And I say random because I'm talking about the Riemannian situation where you would naturally, if you're doing sort of, you know, quantum theory in the Riemannian situation means random stuff. If you had a Lorentzian space-time, you would be thinking about quantum non-commutative geometry, but here it's random. And then eventually we want to couple with the finite space. We'll take a product. And then we can do particle physics on this random geometry. That's the idea. So these two, as definitions are done, and there's a paper about this. This is what I'm talking about. This is in progress. So we just kind of started this project. And I'm going to show you some numerical results about this, but they're very preliminary, and I don't want you to get too excited about it because there isn't a grand conclusion about what you can do or can't do. We just started doing it, and we've observed a few things and can show you something that's interesting and some things we don't understand. So it's very preliminary in a way. And this is very much in the future. This coupling with particle physics. It's something I haven't even started thinking about. But once this is set up in the right way, then there's no more mathematical formalism because this finite space is the same sort of gadget as my new non-commutative geometry. So coupling them together is straightforward. Okay, so that's the general scheme. Where can I go next? Yeah, let's go here. And let's not make that mistake. I use this board first. Right, so what am I going to calculate? So a partition function in this setup means I form some integral over this space of Dirac operators. So curly G is some space of all the possible Dirac operators, and I'm going to integrate over that space with some measure dd. And I'm going to integrate this weight factor e to the minus sd. So s is your action, if you like. And then if you want the expectation value of something, so given some function from curly G to, say, the complex numbers, you can calculate the expectation value of f as 1 over z times the integral, similar integral, but with f in it, That's the idea. And the thing that makes this computable is the finite number of modes. So let's explain about that a bit. So our Dirac operator is a map on some Hilbert space. Operator on the Hilbert space, and the idea is that this Hilbert space is finite dimensional. And now you see. So let's explain. If you were in the commutative case, if you just went back to being commutative for a minute. The only algebras that are possible here, and I'm talking complex algebras because don't want to complicate it and bring in the real case, but in complex ones, you just have copies of C. In other words, this is just the functions on a finite set of points. And each point has, you know, a single function value on it, and that's what, yeah. Okay, so you have a set of points, and the value of the function on each point is the C. But if you're non-commutative, then you can do better than this, and you can have an algebra which is matrix algebra. So you have M N 1 C plus M N 2 C, and so on. The finite number of those. And these, I mean, the n by n matrices. So this thing here stands for n1 by n1 matrices. In other words, the points can have much more structure in them in a non-commutative setting. And that makes it interesting. And here I'm going to take the simplest case. So today, I'm just going to take the algebra to be one matrix algebra. And this goes by the name of a fuzzy space. And as such, they've been quite well studied for the last 25 years or so. And you see, so from the point of view of doing physics, and doing physics where you truncate to a finite number of modes, then there are just these sort of two options. If you stay commutative, then you have a finite set of points, and this is essentially a lattice theory. So, you know, physics on a lattice is quite well studied. but there's another option, and that's the fuzzy space option, and that's what we're investigating here. So if you like, you can think of this algebra matrices as some sort of approximation to the functions on some smooth manifold. And the way you think about that is that amongst all the matrices, there are matrices that are very close to the diagonal. And when you calculate the commutators of those, you get very small matrices. So those matrices sitting in there almost commute. So they nicely approximate the functions on some commutative manifold. But as you get further and further away from the diagonal of the matrices, you get stuff where the non-commutation is more violent. And eventually you reach, you know, the outer edges of the matrix, so to speak. Things don't commute as maximally as possible, and then it stops. And that's sort of the cutoff. That's where you reach the sort of physical cutoff. So you can think of something, an element in here as a sort of function on a space. Function on a space with a cutoff. A cutoff in momenta, in momentum, in wave, yeah. So there's a cutoff in momentum, if you like. In other words, there's a there's a shortest wavelength. So that's very interesting from a physics perspective. So that's, you know, that's what we call the Planck scale, quantum gravity. So I want you to think of this cutoff as being somehow the Planck scale. Okay, how am I doing? I've got half an hour left. Good. So that's the introduction done. So any questions so far?
This looks like one of the AF algebras I was talking about.
It does, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so details, yeah. So I want some details somewhere. Yeah, I'm going to put the details over here.
Depending on what S might be, I mean, this looks like random matrix theory.
Yeah, it's random Dirac operators, and the Dirac operators are matrices. It's just that you're not doing all random or all matrices. You're doing random matrices of a very particular sort, the ones that happen to be Dirac operators.
Yeah, you have like self-adjoint ensembles and other things.
Yeah, well, that'll come in, yeah. Okay, so now Borg control. Do the back one first. Right. So, some details. So we fixed two numbers p and q, integers. And then there's a Clifford algebra with that signature. So you have gamma matrices. And I want p of them to square to 1. And the remaining q to square to minus 1. Plus q squared is minus 1. So the first p are Hermitian, and the second, first, yeah, and the second q are anti-Hermitian. And so obviously the p plus q is the dimension. And actually, what I want to call the signature is q minus p mod 8. It's the signature. That's the number that comes into the properties of those gamma matrices, Clifford algebras. Okay, and so for each choice of P and Q, you can have some Dirac operators. So I'm going to call those the type PQ Dirac operators. So here, the Hilbert space is the following thing. It's a vector space tensored with the Riemann matrices. And the vector space is just CK, and it's the space that the gamma matrices act on. So K is whatever it has to be. It's 2 to the D over 2 in the even case. And 2 to the D minus 1 over 2 in the odd case. So in particular, these are irreducible here. Okay. So now I'm going to write very explicit formulas for the Dirac operator. And so I'm just going to start writing from the lowest dimensional case upwards and then stop at some point where we ran out of steam. So D equals 1. There are two possibilities. Well, firstly, the spinners are trivial. So the Hilbert space is just matrices. And so the 1-0 case, the Dirac operator is just an anticommutator with a Hermitian matrix. So H here is Hermitian. And in the 0-1 case, it's an anticommutator. With an anti-Hermitian matrix. And you have to put in the gamma matrices. And for this example, the gamma matrix is 1. And for this example, it squares to minus 1. So I'm going to call it that minus I. Could be I, of course. Doesn't matter, really. Just turned out to be minus I in the paper. Okay, let's keep going. So the, of course, let's put the S values on. It's Q minus P mod 8, so this is S equals 7, this one here, and this is S equals 1. So let's do some D equals 2 cases. And now the spinner space is C2. So the Hilbert space is C2 tensor matrices. See, so you're thinking this Hilbert space is analogous to the Hilbert space of sections of a spinner bundle on the manifold. Because this is like the functions on the manifold, and this is tensoring with the fiber, which is the spinners. Yeah. So. And you'll notice there's sort of no topology. You can't sort of twist the C2 over the, that doesn't make any sense. And in fact, there seems to be a general thesis which it's true in embarrassingly few examples known, which is that you can't give a finite analog of a bundle that's non-trivial. So it's only when you trivialize the bundle that you can actually then do a finite approximation with matrices. So, for example, if you start with a two-sphere and then you have so if you have spinners over the two-sphere, then actually the bundle is trivial. So you can do that, and that's why the fuzzy sphere works. Yeah. Okay. So let's keep going. So the 2-0 case, the Dirac operator looks like this. So now I have to put the gamma matrices in, and there's two of them. And they're both anticommutators with Hermitian matrices. There's a 1-1 case. That's the same. But the remaining gamma matrix is anti-Hermitian, so it goes with a commutator. Don't need the one in that case. And then there's the 0-2 case. And now they're both anti-commutators. Both commutators, excuse me. Okay, these are anti-Hermitian here, and square to minus 1. Okay. So I'm only going to do one three-dimensional case, and then I'll stop. But just to show you that the way it continues isn't totally trivial. So here, you start with a anti-commutator, and then you have three commutator terms. And the original fuzzy sphere Dirac operator of Grosse and Presnada is of this sort, and is you can write it like this. In fact, in their fuzzy sphere, these are angular momentum generators. They're very particular matrices, and this here is just a constant. Yes? Sorry, this is the 0,3 case. So let's record the S values. This is S equals 6, S equals 0, S equals 2, this is S equals 3. And there's some general properties that you can... Now, let me just say a bit about this first. So this has gotten more complicated because it's not just single gamma matrix terms. In fact, the way you can think of this term is that really there should be three gamma matrices, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. But because we're in odd dimensions, that's just one. But if you went up to, say, to four-dimensional case, there would be... there'd be four terms with a single gamma matrix, and there'd be four terms with three gamma matrices. So you'd have eight terms. So yeah, so the formulas do, you know, do start to get a bit more complicated as you go up.
What's the square of the mean?
Well, it's just a calculation. It's not very enlightening.
It's not anything enlightening. Well, I mean, this anti-commutator is not a derivation. I mean, why you put it there?
It's the non-commutative analog.
Well, I'm not sure I understand. Not with the analog of differential is a derivation, but this is not a derivation.
Yeah, but that's not how you do it. I mean, what you do is you write down all the axioms for the Dirac operator from non-commutative geometry, and you then solve them. So there's a classification theorem, and I've just given you the result of the classification. So I'm sorry, I missed a whole load of theory out there.
But maybe the question is why in the 1,0 case, anti-commutator, you could give a feeling why this is not the other one. This one is a derivation, the first one. Yeah.
I see.
Why this one? I mean, that should be easy to explain why this is a nice derivation in the non-commutator.
It's not. Don't think it's a derivation. No, it's a Dirac operator. It's not an exterior derivative. It's not a. It's not a differential. It's a Dirac operator. Well, that's a good question.
So it satisfies the first order axioms?
Yes.
Satisfies
all the axioms, yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
So in other words, it's got all the analogous properties to a Dirac operator on a commutative manifold.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did that
just that the algebra is non-commutative. I mean,
But this Jordan product makes sense in the commutative case. Does it arise in the commutative case?
The Jordan product. No. You can read too much into these. I mean, and you can start dreaming in various algebraic directions, but actually, you know, that's not necessarily what it means. Okay, so I've got a little bit of space left for how much time have I got, Shane?
Oh, you've got about 15 minutes.
15, okay. 20. Right. So anyway, I've told you very explicitly what the Dirac operators are, and I hope you could go away and reproduce them to higher dimensions if you wanted to. So what else do I need for my project here? Well, I need to know what S is, the action, and I need to know what good Fs are to measure, and then I'm ready to go. So let me just tell you briefly. I'll put it here if I can fit it in. Let's move that. So the action is the following. So we take the general formula is S of D is trace of some potential of D, trace of V of D. And this goes by the name of a spectral action. And of course, that means you can write it as the sum of the wrote that in the wrong place. The sum of the eigenvalues of V of the eigenvalues, basically like this. And the formulas we tried are V of D is D squared, simplest one, sort of Gaussian, if you like. And we also tried D fourth plus some constant D squared. So I'll show you the results for those in a minute. But of course, you know, you can free to try any formula you like. And so an interesting question is, what is a good formula for this action? So there's a canonical example in the literature called the Kohn-Chamsuddin spectral action. And there they have a potential like this, sort of cutoff potential. So this is V. And this doesn't work in our framework. And you can convince yourself very quickly that this doesn't converge if you do this. So perhaps I should just say a little bit more. These matrices are free data, these H and L. Well, you see, the L's always come in commutators. And so it's clearly the trace part doesn't play any role. So these are anti-Hermitian, you might as well have them trace-free. But then once you determine that, these are free data. And of course, such things, and D is linear in the H's and L's, so it forms a vector space. So there's a vector space of Dirac operators. So my integration here, this is just the standard Lebesgue measure. and this thing here is a vector space. So, you know, it couldn't be simpler. Okay. So the only other thing I need to tell you is what are we going to measure? And the two observables we looked at, the Fs in that formula, firstly, the ith eigenvalue. So if you order the eigenvalues from lowest to highest and then take the ith one, that's a good thing to measure. And the other thing is the density of eigenvalues. So you F at lambda, the density at lambda is 1 over the number of eigenvalues times the sum delta minus lambda I. So you sum over all eigenvalues and you put a delta function where you get an eigenvalue. And now I calculate the average of that, and of course it will smooth out as you integrate. So that's the details. Any questions about the details?
I just I mean, Masoud's question seems to me he almost might want to ask the opposite. I mean, I suppose n equals one is a legitimate case. But then when n equals one by one matrices, then the lead brackets will vanish. But the all you get is the then it seems to me that's suggesting that the ordinary Dirac operator comes from the anti Dirac commutator.
Well, yeah, the n equals one case isn't very interesting, but we'll be using.
Why isn't that?
We'll be using
the commutative case is interesting. That's where that Dirac.
Well.
Well, no, it doesn't include Dirac.
Yeah, well, so that's a single, I mean, it's a point with no other structure, and then the Dirac operator would be zero,
well,
so
points, at least
that's perfectly fine.
You've got B equals C.
Oh, okay, in this example, yeah, it would be 2 points. Yeah. No, it's a spinner over a point, and so you'd have the left-handed and the right-handed particles. But the Dirac operator would be zero. If you only have 1 point, there's nowhere to go, so. Anyway, so...
But does that generalize to more general vector spaces? I'm somehow discounting the restriction that the B is equal to C squared. I mean, I'm imagining that B can be anything.
No, 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 it's the spinner space.
Yeah.
Very differently. Anyway, let me show you the results now. So you will have to swivel around here to see.
Sorry, before you, so
yeah.
You said the integral is divergent in constant.
Yeah.
So you mean that pass integral?
Sorry, what?
You mean the pass integral?
Yeah, 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 because you see, because it's a vector space, you can,
yeah.
You can start with a Dirac operator, you can multiply by any scale, and all the eigenvalues get large, and then they all go above the cutoff. And so V of it is zero. And so for large Dirac operators, you're integrating one all the way out to infinity. Divergent. In fact, I didn't realize this. And I even stupidly asked Lisa to do it on the computer. And she came back and said, it does a random walk and all the eigenvalues get larger and larger. And I went, of course, so it does. So, yeah. So you learn a lot of things by actually doing some computations. Yeah, yeah, it's exactly it. Yes, it's a very large cosmological constant. The eigenvalues get large, so the space is very small. Yeah, yeah, so that's bad. But what we're doing doesn't. Anyway, so here we go with the results. This is a bit with Lisa. There's the Dirac operators. So firstly, the d squared action, so that's Gaussian. And then looked at the very simplest cases, the 1, 0, and 0, 1. Here, the commutator and anti-commutator. And then, of course, in the case of 1, 0, the anti-commutator, the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator are just the sums of the eigenvalues of the matrix H. So you're basically doing a random matrix model with matrix H. H is a Hermitian matrix. So it's a Gaussian random matrix model. But the thing you're interested in is the sums of all pairs of eigenvalues, not just the eigenvalues. And then for the 0, 1 case with the commutator, it's the difference. So that's easy. So, and here's the actual action. If you write trace d squared and then unravel it in terms of h, you find trace h squared, so that's the usual Gaussian random matrix, and then an extra term with the trace, which actually doesn't do too much to the... So the results are similar to the Gaussian random matrix model, which is what you get if you just didn't have that term. So where's the first? Yeah, so here we go. So this is the... up here is the average eigenvalues of H here. And you'll see a little thing here. This is the error bars in our computation here. So we're doing size 5 by 5, n equals 5 here. So there's 5 eigenvalues, and they're nicely spaced out because it's random matrices. And then here is the statistics of the sum, that's the type 1, 0. And here's the statistics of the difference, that's the 0, 1. And of course, 5 of them are identical to 0 because they're differences of when two of the eigenvalues are the same. So mu minus mu is naught. And so you always get this collection of eigenvalues there. So, so this thing, and you can see from here, of course, all the matrices that commute with that are going to be 0 eigenvectors. So. So those cases are rather simple. And here's a bit of stuff about random matrices. And in random matrices, you can write the probability distribution of the eigenvalues, and you have the original e to the minus action. But there's this Jacobian term here from changing the variables to eigenvalues. And it vanishes when the two eigenvalues are equal. So what it tells you in random matrices is that there's a tendency for the eigenvalues to repel. So they don't like being on top of each other, and they like to be spaced apart. And then that influences what happens to the Dirac operators. So this is the standard statistics of a random Gaussian random matrix. This is the Wigner semicircle law. So now we're just looking at the eigenvalues of the matrix H or the matrix L here in the two cases. So eigenvalue along the bottom, and this is density on this axis here. And this is the standard Wigner semicircle, so that fits very well. Then for the Dirac, we have the following things. 5 minutes, yeah. So this is the eigenvalues for the Dirac operator in the 1-0 case, and this is the eigenvalues for the 0-1 case. And here you see this spike at the origin, which is where those zero eigenvalues are. And then this sort of well here is the repulsion, because a lot of eigenvalues are zero, you can't have any near to them because they like to repel. See, so there's a sort of bit missing from that thing.
You mean, is there a universal law in this case?
Yeah, this is pretty universal. Yes. Yeah, and this thing will get smaller in the large end limit. You can see that. okay, so that's very simple, the one-dimensional type. So now we want to go to the two-dimensional types. So this is what happens with type 2-0 and type 1-1. In fact, they're very similar. This is the eigenvalue distributions. And there's an intriguing sort of peak here at the origin, which we didn't see, in fact, in the 1-0 case. So the, you know, you might think the 2-0 case, it looks very similar to the 1-0 case here, but actually, you know, statistics behaves rather differently, like this. And the 1-1 case is a complete mystery to me. In fact, why it's so similar to the 2-0 case, I have very little idea.
Relative sizes of the H and the L to use some.
Oh, they're both random matrices.
With this normalized in some natural way.
Yeah, well, you just plug in the Dirac operator formula and calculate trace of the square, and you get an expression which you don't actually have at the end of this file I could show, but yeah. okay, let's move on, show you a few more. This is type 0-2. So this is where you have two commutators and gamma matrices. And this you sort of do understand. Here's that dip in the middle again with the big spike. And again, you can show that there's a lot of states in the Hilbert space which are zero eigenvalues again for this. So this is sort of still a bit degenerate in a sense that's not. Yeah, you'd, if you're trying to approximate a smooth manifold, you wouldn't want to see that sort of behavior.
The spike grows like n?
Yeah, that's right. So the number of eigenvalues is going like n squared, and the spike is growing like n. So it is becoming insignificant as you make n large, but it's still there in some way.
That, because I would say, you know, if you have a continuous manifold, then derivative has a huge number of zero mode. I mean, this is the space-time is the set of zero mode of.
Yeah, but what,
so you need a big.
What manifold has a? But what manifold has a huge number of zero modes?
I mean, things space time by itself is the set of, you know, zero modes of D. No, you don't view it like that.
No, I don't know. Anyway, but yeah. So, and this thing here just sort of smooths out as you make matrices larger. This is 15 by 15. So that's the small matrix, the things in here. The Dirac then is then an operator on 15 by 15 matrices times 2. So that's 400. So this is 450 by 450. Yeah. now this is very intriguing. I love this one. This is the 0-3 case. And all that nonsense at the origin has vanished. And this is the first time it happens. We have a completely nice, smooth thing here at the origin. And that's, see, so what do we expect? I mean, if you're looking at a, where can I go? Yeah, so if you're looking at a smooth manifold, the density of states will depend on the dimension. So dimension one, you would have a constant density of states here. And in dimension two, you would have a linear density of states like that. In fact, it's always one less power than the dimension. But you certainly don't see anything spiky at the origin in the usual, you know, on a smooth manifold. this is rho. Lambda. Okay. And the average eigenvalues, they do lie on a really nice smooth curve. And, you know, and again, this is evidence that, that the repulsion effect in random matrices also works for random Dirac operators, which, you know, I think is a highly non-trivial thing that, you know, trying to analyze this, and I thought about it for a while, it's not at all obvious how to read the results over. These plots just tell you that as you go to larger matrices, the dispersion of an individual eigenvalue gets smaller. So if you look, say, at the blue blob there, that's for a 5x5 matrix. There it is for a 10x10, and then it's even narrower for a 15x15. So just like in random matrices, the eigenvalues are becoming uncorrelated, or that their spread is becoming small. Now, this is what happens if we add a D4th term. So this is just D4th, no D squared. And it sort of changes the picture a bit. These don't change very much. This is the one I like most. This is the three-dimensional, the 0, 3 one. And we're getting more or less a completely flat top here now. So I'd like to claim with not much other evidence that this is behaving like a one-dimensional geometry here, because it's looking like a flat top. And the sides, of course, go down because that's the Planck cutoff. So I think this is looking like a Planck cutoff one-dimensional random geometry. Maybe.
I mean, that's Chomsky's cutoff function there coming out explicitly from that. Is that what you mean?
Oh, well, this is the eigenvalue distribution. So I don't know. That's not the same thing as their cutoff function. Their cutoff function is sort of an input. This is output.
No, I mean, in other words, that's what I mean.
You're I see. Yeah, right. So, yeah, I'm getting as output the thing they assume as an input. Yeah, right. Okay, yeah, maybe, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what happens, and you can vary the mixture of D4th and D squared. And the most fun thing is when you have a negative coefficient. So this is a double well potential. And you can sort of understand from the random matrix point of view what's going on in these two cases here, type 1, 0 and 0, 1. And the type 1, 0, you notice the axes here doesn't include the origin, because this is one minimum. There's another one out the door somewhere. And the individual matrices don't have to be symmetric in the spectrum. So they can all just live in one minimum or the other one. So this Monte Carlo run has lived in that minimum, and that's what you get. and the spread is, of course, in that minimum, is the repulsion of the eigenvalues. Right, and then these, of course, the eigenvalues are the sums of the eigenvalues of the random matrix, but they're all, since they're all in the same place, the sums are all roughly like that. This is the 0, 1, where you're looking at a random matrix which is traceless, so it can't have all the eigenvalues the same. So some are positive and some are negative, and then you take differences, and then you get three bumps, you see. So you can sort of understand what's going on there.
Do you have a large number of slides?
No, two or three more. Yeah, nearly done. So this is the 2-0 with this nice Higgs potential. And again, you can understand this as eigenvalues collecting at the bottom of the potential well. But this is the one we really don't understand. This is completely wacky. This is the type 0-2 case with this Higgs potential here. And this is the minimum of the potential. But the stuff splurges out in a pattern like this, which we actually have very little understanding of what's going on. You know, despite staring at graphs of the data that comes out of the computer, it's very hard to see why you're getting this pattern.
Doesn't it look a bit like an interference pattern?
Who knows? I mean, in my wildly optimistic dreams, I think it's you know, starting to look a bit like this picture, but maybe that's probably too much to... No, it probably isn't. I really don't know. But it's completely unexpected. You would expect the eigenvalues to collect at the bottom of the potential, and they really don't. They start to spread everywhere in a pattern that we don't understand. So, that's it really. That's as far as I've got.
We're running about 2 minutes late, so if there's one quick question, otherwise we can move to lunch. I'll have one quick question.
What was P lambda in this example?
It's just the probability of the eigenvalue lambda.
Being between.
Yeah, you see, you're counting the statistics and you bin it up in a bin and then count the number in there. So it's a density of eigenvalues.
Why didn't you look at the cubic case?
The cubic potential?
Yeah, cubic,
well, then the thing wouldn't be bounded, you see.
Oh, I see.
It's got to go up on both sides.
Yeah, but I mean, you can have divergent integrals, but.
But then we can't Monte Carlo it.
Oh, no,
right.
Yeah. They're not oscillatory anyhow.
Yeah. We could do it also. Yes. No, that's a project, yeah. That's a nice project, yeah. No, there's loads of things to do. There's so many. Yeah, so just say this to everybody. There's loads of things to do in this subject. There's just so much to do that I don't have time to do it all. So, anyway.